being the president of January 1st, 1930, I think, would be, if you looked up at the...
January 31st?
January the 1st.
January the 1st,
yeah.
1930?
1930, and Fordham Johnson retired, of course, on December 31st of 29 as president. But I think that he stayed on as the chairman of the board for a couple of years. He became lieutenant governor around 1932. I couldn't tell you the dates for sure.
Board and he and lieutenant governor.
Yeah, and he was lieutenant governor for maybe 4 years or something.
Let's just check and see if this thing works.
When you came to the refinery?
I started in May 1929. Okay. I came out of UBC, and that was my first job, the only job I ever had.
Is that
until after I retired.
Are you one of the great trekkers?
No, I wasn't there. I came to Vancouver in 1929.
Uh-huh.
And the great trek was in 22 or 23.
That was when was UBC on the Point Grey?
I went out the first year that they're out there.
I see.
I was born in Victoria, and I was brought up there, and I went to Victoria College and took the 2 years of arts that was available there. And then I came over here and went into applied science.
Applied science, so you're an engineer.
A chemical engineer.
I see. You came in May 1929, not long after Mr. Ernest Rogers became president.
Now, no, I was here before he was president. He was vice president. It was he that interviewed me, as a matter of fact, and he had his office upstairs in the old office building in what was the boardroom, and he just had a desk in the corner. Life here was a very simple sort of thing compared to what it is today. Mm-hmm. The refinery was the only operation they had, and it's as you know, is a sort of a day-to-day thing. It just keeps on going, and while the company kept on expanding over the years, I mean, their business increased year by year, and they were always doing construction work. And this 1930 period is extremely interesting as far as I'm concerned. It was when the company then became a real entity. There were the place was run from a business point of view by the president, the vice president, and the secretary. When I first came here, Fordham Johnson was the president, and he was a pretty smart financial man. He knew absolutely nothing about what went on out in the refinery. And used to make some. You haven't got the recorder on. I don't want to have this recorded. But
okay.
He was a very pompous man, and he liked to give an appearance of knowledge. And I mean, I'm not downgrading him, but this was the type of fellow he was. And just before I came here, there was an important delegation of people had come here. I've forgotten who it was, the governor general or somebody, and they'd been invited to inspect the refinery, and he took them around and showed them. He didn't know what he was telling them, and he went backwards. He started in the packing house, went backwards. I mean, it was, according to stories, it was a bit of a disaster. But it was he, I think, that established the sort of the financial background after BT died. As I get it, BT was a sort of a one-man band. He made all the decisions, and while they had a board of directors, he was the managing director, and he had a great deal of authority, and of course he controlled the company in a way, I presume, financially. And so when he died, there was a big reorganization of the company, and you'll find that, I'm sure, in the records. And they became a Dominion corporation. They have a Dominion charter. They don't have a provincial charter. And that was done during his time, and I'm pretty sure that he was the genius to set up the sort of the holding company bit, which is BC Sugar Refinery, which you buy the shares in,
uh-huh.
and the operating company that were they didn't make any financial reports to anybody but the board of directors. So it was a very closely guarded secret where they made the money and everything else, because I'm sure they've got copies of some of the old financial statements, and this was before your father came here, and it was just a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And one side they showed that the BC Sugar Refinery Limited, which was the public corporation, owned so many shares of BC Sugar Refining, BC Sugar Refining Company Limited, which was the operating company, and it was incorporated as a company, but the whole control was invested in the corporation, you see. So their financial report read, there was an item of $5 and some cents, which was always carried forward as on the books, you see. And then the refining company would pay X thousands of dollars in dividends to the refinery corporation, and that would add up to, can't remember what the dividends were, but say $200,000 would be transferred for dividends,
uh-huh.
with this $5 something. That was the input side. On the debit side, they would pay out the $200,000 in dividends, and they'd be left with this $5. Yeah. You should try and find some of those old financial reports. And of course, that was the laughingstock of the financial community, because nobody knew what was going on in the place. And eventually, when they got listed, they have to disclose a hell of a lot more. And of course, they turned out a pretty good financial report now, and not nearly so secretive as it was in those days. But I'm sure that Fordham Johnson was the genius that set that up, because it was a very small company, and the shares were held with, I don't know how many shareholders they had. They may have only had 100 shareholders for all I know.
Uh-huh.
But you could buy shares of BC Sugar Refinery over the counter. But all the shareholders got was this stupid little piece of paper with these three figures on it or whatever it was, and no report as to whether the company was doing well or not, because they weren't involved in the operations. Well, then, of course, the big turnover came when they bought into Canadian Sugar Factories in 1931,
mm-hmm.
and that changed.
ETR?
Yeah, well, he was responsible for it, you see. I don't know if you've ever read a copy of a book, and I'm sure there's some of them around here still, that Mrs. B.T. Rogers.
Yes, we have one right here.
Yeah, well, that'll give you, I have a copy or two of it at home, because I helped write a lot of the stuff in there at the time when it was published. And Mrs. B.T. did all the editing, and she just extracted what she wanted out of whatever was presented to her.
Uh-huh.
And so I had some input into it, which was very interesting. But the thing changed very radically in 1931, when they had this subsidiary company. And for instance, when I first came here, there were only, I think, three people who had the authority to sign a letter. And one of them was the president, and one was the vice president, and the other was the secretary. And then Mr. Boyd, who was the chief chemist when I came here, he had to write letters to people and so on. He would write the letters, but the letter would go out over the signature of Adamson or Ernie Rogers.
Adamson was who?
Well, he was the secretary, and you'll find out about him in here.
Uh-huh.
And he later became the the vice president, when Ernie was the president, he became the vice president, and he was simply an accountant type.
Uh-huh.
And he was a real character. He was a Scotchman and a bachelor, and he always wore a hat in the office, and he would be sitting at his desk with his hat on. He was bald as a billiard ball, and I guess... and,
making way for my father.
yeah, I guess I hadn't thought of that, but he was bald too, wasn't he? What a much different kind of character, may I say.
So Mr. Adamson was Mr. E.T. Rogers' vice president.
Yeah, and he had started off as an accountant, and I think they'll give you his background in that book.
Okay.
There's some very good information about the history of the company.
Uh-huh.
And then, when they got this factory, Mr. Boyd was made general superintendent. He had the power over all the technical side of the operations, and he became much more than just a technical director, you might have called him, but he always had the title of general superintendent. And they got into the hassle with the labor unions. He became the personnel manager, essentially. He did the negotiating and that sort of thing, until eventually he was heading towards retirement, and they realized that they had to split off some of the things he did. And Reggie Clark came in. That's when Reggie became the first personnel manager. Well, of course, that's much later than 1939.
Yeah.
In the 30s was the big changeover, when the executive, like Ernie, and who was really the power of the corporation, because he was a very brilliant man, and he knew in the 10 years that he was vice president, well, just going back before that, Ernie had very little association with the refinery. Before his brother died, he'd been overseas during the war, and while all the Rogers boys all worked in the refinery, Blythe was the one that was sort of picked by his dad, and he was the eldest son, to be his successor. Well, of course, B.D. was 54 when he died, so nobody expected him to die. He died very suddenly. And so Blythe, who was, he was born in 1893, I think, in 1929, you see, he would have been in his, in 1920, he would have been in his early 20s.
Uh-huh.
And became the president and operated much the same as his dad had. That his father was his mentor, I'm quite sure. I say I'm speaking secondhand because I wasn't here in those days. And then he was president for less than 2 years, and he died very suddenly, and Ernie became the boss, and Ernie had very little contact with the refinery, and I'm quite sure that this was one reason why Fordham Johnson was brought back, because he had retired and was responsible for the really the financial side of things, but he took responsibility for the whole operation. In the meantime, Ernie set to work, and he learned a lot about the financial side of things, and he also learned a lot about the technical side, and he became very interested in the technical operations of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through him that he had a very good association with the C&H refinery in California, and they helped him a great deal, and he eventually brought they had to enlarge the filter house and one thing or another, and update the refinery. The thing was getting pretty antiquated by the time he came in there. And he got the people from C&H to help him, and they actually brought a man named Blowski, who was the chief chemist.
Blowski? How would you spell Blowski?
B-L-O-W-S-K-I. And he, I met him a few times, but by the time I got to know the sugar fraternity, he had retired from CNH. But he was a very fine man, and he came here as an advisor, and he helped Mr. Boyd set up what was, when I arrived here, called the Technical Control Department. Mm-hmm. And all the control of the refinery was centered in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. There were no technically people, trained people in the organization except Robert Boyd. He was the only man with a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I was I wasn't the second to be employed, because they did hire another fellow that didn't stay before I came. But Mr. Boyd and I, until 1932, I guess, were the only people with any academic background.
Right.
And that third man was Ballou, who became chief engineer, and I'm sure you've heard of him.
Yeah.
And he was brought in from the States when they got into the beet sugar business, because they had to have proper, they had no engineer in the place, a mechanical person. They had a master mechanic and a draftsman who did all the mechanical planning for the place.
Uh-huh.
And Rennie was the master mechanic.
Rennie?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. The reason I'm asking these names is it's a lot easier to look.
Yeah, well, you'll find a lot of these names mentioned in this book. Good. It gives you a really good picture.
Uh-huh.
So that gives you a little background of it.
Now, Mr. E.T. Rogers would do all the hiring, wouldn't he, of the professional staff?
Oh, yeah, sure, he hired me. I never saw Fordham Johnson until after I came to work here. I think I graduated on the 4th of May. I think that was graduation day. And I had an association with the old Union Oil Company here, and I thought I would go into the oil business when I graduated. In 1929, engineers were in tremendous demand. It was at the height of the boom, you see, of the 29 mm-hmm. boom. And so there was no problem finding jobs, and I had made a commitment with Union Oil that I would go down to California, where the headquarters was, and the day before graduation, I went out to the university, and Dr. Clark, who was head of the chemistry department, was helpful, and I got a telegram from Union Oil telling me not to come,
mm-hmm.
and I'm quite convinced in my own mind that this was the forerunner of the Great Depression, of the big companies down in the States had already foreseen that there was going to be trouble. This was 5 months before the stock crash. And I was told not to come, so I had to go out there to see Clark, and he said, well, it's too bad, but he said, I've got a call from BC Sugar, and they want somebody, a chemical engineer, and so I went down, and I was the last of the people available, so they had to hire me if they wanted somebody, and that's how I got in here.
Mr. Rogers has quite a reputation as a philanthropist during the 30s.
Well, yeah, I suppose you would call him a philanthropist. He and his wife, I guess you knew Irene.
Yes.
You never knew Ernie.
No.
But they were a great team. And they both had a great, what I would call, a social consciousness. And when he came in here, they had about 450 people working, more or less, because they used to hire and fire people on a day basis. I mean, if they had a big shipping day, and they need a lot of labor, because it was all hand-trucked, all the sugar in the shipping department, it was all hand-trucked.
Yeah.
They would hire fellows. There'd always be a few guys standing out in the street looking for a job, and so the fellow named Fred Butcher, who was a real character, and he was the yard foreman, and he was responsible, you see, for the sort of the labor pool.
Uh-huh.
He would get word from the shipping department, for instance, that they needed four or five men. He'd go out in the street here, and he would beckon to three or four guys and tell them to come in, and they would work for half a day or a day, whatever they needed. And they'd get paid off.
Yeah.
So they had a great floating labor force when they needed men, and laid them off just as quickly. Then in the summertime, we always rushed to death because of the fruit crop and all the stuff that went on. Wintertime, the thing would become pretty dull, and so they just lay off everybody that they didn't need, and they'll be fine. Of course, the operators were all steady working people, but they had this labor force where you were doing bull work, like trucking sugar, or if a ship was in and you had to pile bags of sugar and this sort of thing. So it was a very flexible sort of thing. Well, Ernie came in, and he was very intimate with the operations of the refinery because he set himself out to learn this. And he realized that a lot of these people had many hardships. If a fellow was sick, he got no pay. If he was hurt, the compensation board would pick up the tab for some compensation, which was two-thirds of his pay. And I think he was very conscious of this. And they had a lot of old fellows that had worked for the refinery for years, fellows that were 60, 70. I think we had one or two fellows that were over 70 working as steady operators. And a lot of these men were illiterate. Some of them couldn't sign their names even.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, times have changed. And so when Ernie got in the saddle, and then the great unemployment hit us about 1930-31.
The really bad unemployment.
Yeah, you see, I mean, it took about a year after the stock crash for things really to get tough in Vancouver. And so he decided that he would guarantee employment to the permanent employees. And he reduced the number of operators, and he cut out, to a large extent, this offhand hiring. There was no labor union, there was no agreement, but he was made verbal statements, which he honored, and he said, well, I'll guarantee, we'll cut our staff to a certain number of people that we needed for operating and so on, and we'll guarantee you steady employment, and you'll get paid 52 weeks in the year for the people who are on the permanent staff. And so this was the first thing he did. Well, he chopped out, of course, a lot of the old-timers, people that were, well, he set up that everybody would retire at 65. So
mm-hmm.
he tossed out all the people that were over 65 in a period of a few months, and they gave them a pension, and then they, in those days, they gave them $1 a day. This was just paid out of operating costs. There were no pension fund or anything, and the
mm-hmm.
company just assumed this thing, and so they got rid of a lot of fellows, and most of them had worked here for a long time, and they were able to take care of themselves, and $30 a month bought a hell of a lot of groceries
yeah.
in 1930, you
yeah.
see. So this was the thing that he started off with. And then he said that they would set up this medical plan and compensation for men that were sick, if they got sick. And they hired a company doctor, and everybody could go to the company doctor at no cost, and if the company doctor certified that you were sick, then they got compensation equal to what the compensation board was, so that the worker who was supporting a family, who still had his money coming in. Then, these didn't all happen at one time. Then They used to have these great Christmas parties for all the employees, and he'd get up and make a little speech at these things, and for, I suppose, 4 or 5 years in a row, he'd always come up with some little goodie at Christmas time. He said, well, next year we're going to have a medical plan, and so on down the line, and then they increased the medical plan with a small contribution from the employees, and the company matched the money, and this paid for operations and extended the thing. I can't remember the actual dates, mm-hmm. but this is how the thing extended. And about 1938, I guess it would be, a delegation of fellows went into Ernie's office one day and said that, you know, they thought that this $1 a day pension was inadequate by this time. Of course, the cost of living was going up again a bit, and wanted to see if they could set up a contributory plan with the employees putting something in, the company putting in. And so he said, sure. So they went to work, and they got some actuarial advice and one thing and another. And this is one of the first jobs of importance, as far as I was concerned, that PT had, was to sort of coordinate this thing. And the
PT was vice president at that point, was he?
No, Adamson. I think PT had the title of works manager, but I can't remember. You'd have to look up the record if you want to find out for sure.
Okay. This would be 1930.
No, this would be 1938. I'm getting ahead of myself because you were talking about the philanthropy of uh-huh. Ernie, you see.
Okay.
And so this is how these things sort of developed.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was about the end of 1938 came up with this report, which I guess went to the board of directors, and they accepted the thing in principle. Unfortunately, Ernie was drowned before the thing was finally established, but the groundwork had already been done. I think it was in the fall of August or September of 39 that the pension plan was started, and that was the forerunner of what we have today, although there have been 2 or 3 revisions of it since then.
I see. Now, he was drowned. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, they were great boat people, you know, and they had a very nice yacht.
Uh-huh.
And he and two of the girls, and Irene, were out up towards Jarvis Inlet, in that area. And the story, as I got it, was that that one of the girls, the boom came around on the yacht and knocked one of the kids overboard, and he jumped in after her, probably just on impulse. The kids were well able to look after themselves, they're all good swimmers and so on, and he never came up.
Really?
Yeah. He never found his body, just like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
How old is he then?
Well, when he says here he was born in 1897, and he would be 39 and 3, 40, yeah, 42. Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, he, as far as I'm concerned, he was the top-notch lad. He really had a social consciousness for the employees. And he developed all this business of when in the Depression years, when people were being laid off and so on, he took great pity on them, and he never cut wages, but he set up the wages on a pretty good scale. And he always paid good wages compared to anybody else, and all these sort of amenities that came into the thing Before that, they'd always had this group insurance policy, and I think that was brought in by Fordham Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got, well, I don't think it was a year's pay. I think that it was $1,000 on the laborers. And I think when I qualified, I had to work for 6 months before I got onto the insurance thing. I think I was insured for $3,000. Well, then later on, I can't give you the dates, it was probably during the war, they changed to a year's pay. I think everybody gets a year's pay now, I'm not sure.
Did he brought in a 40-hour work week, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Maybe you'd like to record. I mean, what I say, you can, it's off the record, but I'm not afraid to say what I want to. I didn't want to tell you on tape that Fordham Johnson was a stuffed shirt, which he was, but he was he was a very able and clever financial man, and he I'm sure set a very fine foundation for the present corporation with his brain.
See, the value of that information, actually, although it'll never be included in any publication now, when I put all these tapes of yourself and John Landeschef and others, I'll put them on large masters, which will last for a long time.
Uh-huh.
Now, it will be very tempting for an industrial historian to come in here and listen to that in 50, 75, or 100 years.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, an archivist never thinks in terms of 10 years.
No, I know, that's
50
right.
To 100. So, when that information comes to the fore, we shall both be long gone to our reward. Nevertheless, it's a very interesting little piece, because there's a picture of Gordon Johnson standing back like as if he was being George the Fifth. And
sure. I know, you know, when you went into his office, he always stood to attention, and he was sitting behind the desk, and he was a very pompous man.
Was he an Easterner, or?
He worked for one of the banks, and he came in here as an accountant in the early days.
Just out of curiosity, he wasn't an Oxford man, was that? Was he?
No. I don't think he had any academic standing. His daughter is. He had two daughters and a son. I don't know what's become of the son. One of the daughters died. The other one is still extant.
Uh-huh.
She's a great friend of some very good friends of mine, and she married Professor Wood, you know, F.G.C. Wood, who was the English professor.
Oh, yes, for heaven's sake.
She's B. Wood.
Oh, that's funny.
You've probably come across her. I mean, she would still know be known by the Rogers family, the older ones. Anyway, I'm sure Elspeth would know her.
Yes.
And so on.
Yes,
but she lives in California. In the wintertime, she lives here in the
yeah,
summer.
I see. So we've covered Ernest. Are there any sort of general impressions, other general impressions of the refinery in those years? What about the CSF deal?
Well, this came up in 1931. We were in the middle of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, BC Sugar always had lots of financial assets.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to make moves. I mean, undoubtedly, I don't know anything about the financial details then, but they always had
mm-hmm.
money, and it was a money-making business, and they, which was okay. When the roof fell in 1929, a lot of the sugar companies in particular, like everybody else, suffered it. One of them was Idaho Sugar Company, which owned a little factory in Raymond.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Canadian Sugar Factories Limited, I think it was a subsidiary. And they wanted some hard cash. And the story was, and Forey, I think, could confirm this or give you further details on it, was that the heavily, you know, I don't know, sugar company, and I've forgotten who it was, offered to sell the plant to Ernie for somewhere around $1 million. I would think it was a little less than that, maybe. And there was a great human cry went up in Alberta, particularly about this, because of course BC Sugar supplied all the sugar in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and BC at that time, and it was a monopoly, and they were accused of being an octopus, and if you look up your cuttings file, where I don't know where it is, but it used, mm-hmm. they used to have one, you can read about what was said about this thing that BC Sugar, the great octopus, had bought the thing, and they would shut this thing down. Well, one thing about Ernie, he was a tightwad, and I say that not being rude. He was very careful of the money, and he had no thoughts of buying out a competitor and just shutting it down for $1 million. And he became very interested in the beet sugar industry in Alberta. And he developed it, and the result was that there was nothing done at the refinery for 10 years of any consequence. There were no building changes. There was very, very little equipment change. They bought the odd packing machine because they had to buy new packing machines to keep up the running and so on. Is this thing being recorded?
Yes.
Okay,
it's all,
that's fine.
All clear.
And so the refinery, apart from doing the maintenance work to keep the place running, there was no new equipment of any significance bought until really after the war.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. The first big project they did, of course, after the war was build a powerhouse because the boilers were getting very old and they were burning powdered coal, which was created a hell of a lot of fly ash, and they thought it was blowing all over the neighborhood here, and the company was getting more and more complaints about the
pollution
and so on. So when they bought that thing, the corporate energy went into developing the beet sugar industry, and of course the first year they were fortunate, they had a good crop of beets, but it was a haywire factory. I mean, it was very remote from Salt Lake City, where the shots were called, when the Mormons owned the place. And if you go back under the files, and you know, we used to write what was called the review, which was a weekly report that was prepared by the chief chemist. Well, if you look up, and I'm sure the files should be available here, of the first years of CSF in Alberta, there's some pretty grim stories about what went on in Raymond, you see, and this factory was all tied together with haywire, and it was all, of course, driven by steam engines with line shafting in all directions. There were very little individual drives. It was all runoff line shafts, you see.
Oh, I see. Now, it wasn't safe then.
Well, I wouldn't say it wasn't safe, but it was just an old-fashioned factory that had seen two locations before it got to Raymond. I've forgotten where the first one is, but you can find out if you're interested where it came from in the first instance. In a book of beet sugar technology by McGinnis, the first edition, and they'll have copies over in the library. If you haven't, I've got one at home that you're welcome to borrow. It was moved then because of the area it was in didn't produce enough beets, and the factory was moved to Sunnyside, Washington, in the Yakima Valley, and they ran into a beet disease there. I think it was white fly or some darn thing that destroyed the beets, and they the factory, at least two of them in the Yakima Valley that belonged to Utah, Idaho, sure, became surplus. Mm-hmm. And the Mormon community in southern Alberta had been agitating to get a new factory built in Raymond. There had been one built there in 1940. You read all that stuff about the Knight Sugar Company. Well, that was a political thing. He got, Knight and the Mormons got these huge land grants from the Canadian government.
I've got to get this on tape. This is very important.
Well, it's all a matter of record elsewhere, but I can't tell you just where to go and look for it. And the Knight Sugar Company was set up, and they had to operate the factory for 10 years to confirm these land grants, which they did, and that's why the little factory was built there. Well, in 1914, the thing was obviously not making any money, and it was a very small operation. Knight stopped it, you see, and the Mormon community, and you should read the history of the Mormon community in southern Alberta because it has a great bearing on the sugar bit, and it's available around in some reports and so on. The Mormon community then got after the church in Salt Lake City to build a factory there. Well, then there was so much agitation from the Mormons in southern Alberta. This factory was, at Sunnyside, was surplus, so they moved it up to Raymond. So it was it was its third stop. And so it was a 600 ton a day operation, I think, and it was a run on the most meager terms. The people that ran it were, there were no professionals involved in it. T. George Wood was the sort of, he was the purchasing agent, I believe, but he became the general manager, and it's covered in Mrs. Rogers' book. And he was an astute Mormon.
Englishman.
Yes, he was born in England. His mother was the one that was converted. The Mormons did a great evangelical job in Europe, you know, around the 1850s.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people in England who were living under frightful conditions, they were attracted to the thought of getting to America, I suppose, and they became very earnest people in the Mormon faith. So he became the general manager, and later he was the he became the general manager, I think, of Alberta, which was a, he had more authority than he did when they first took it over.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. So it had been run on very meager terms, you see, to satisfy the community. Well, Ernie, by this time, was imbued with the knowledge of sound technical control, and Mr. Boyd was his mentor and guide in these things, and Boyd was sent in there, and during those first 2 years, of course, they devoted a lot of their energies to the beet sugar industry and upgrading the sugar factory in Alberta to the detriment of the operations in Vancouver, because of every pound of sugar they made in Alberta was one less that we made here.
Uh-huh.
And so then, of course, in 1936, only 4 years later, or 5 years later, they got the Tribute factory going, and that's when Forey had just graduated the year before from University of BC, and he was a mechanical engineer,
What year was that about?
He graduated in 35, I think.
Uh-huh.
And he went up there, the factory was under construction, and he acted as the chief chemist at the Picture Butte for the first year of its operations. He'll tell you all about that. Ah. He's full of it. And he can give you a lot more background on that, because I didn't get involved in the prairie things until much later. And really until Mr. Boyd died.
Uh-huh.
And so he's the authority on the Alberta thing. Of course, we're talking beyond 39, which is the year that we're supposed to be talking about. So anyway, this is what went on at the refinery.